Hello and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fosfero. Today I'm in the village of Tarbert on the beautiful Isle of Harris in Scotland's Outer Hebrides. Famous for tweed, it's also carving a name for itself in the world of gin. The Isle of Harris distillery took 7 years to come to fruition and was born out of one man's dream to create employment for locals, not just in the short term, but for generations to come. I'm in the distillery's tasting room, a perfect place to be honest, with Shona McLeod, one of the original Tarbert 10, as the first employees are affectionately called. She's offered to share their remarkable story with me today. And Shona, I've got to say, it's a privilege being on your beautiful island. You were born here, weren't you?
I was born here, yes. We're all very proud to call it home.
What makes it so special?
Well, small communities, I suppose, anywhere can be special, can't they? There's a different sort of dynamic because you know everybody, whether they're your neighbour or not, they're never too far away. So you tend to know people. I suppose that has benefits and can be distracting for people as well. But it's just home, it's just normal for me.
When you come from somewhere as beautiful as this, I flew in over the gorgeous white beaches and the fantastic mountainscape. Do you realise how beautiful it is, or is it just home?
I think it's a little bit of both. Certainly when islanders from the Hebrides are younger, they maybe don't appreciate it as much as we do when we get older. Many of us, of course, have gone away to study and to work and then come back, and you certainly appreciate it more then.
And did you go away to study?
I did, yes. Yeah.
What did you do?
I was away for 13 years in Glasgow. I studied hospitality management, worked in restaurants and hotels, and then I moved back home.
Ah, you moved back home for a very special reason, really. I mean, just describe for us, if you can, you know, this is audio only. So describe the setting where we are today in the distillery.
So we're sitting at the moment inside our flavour room, which is my favourite part of the distillery, designed to feel like the inside of a cask, dark charred walls. So we use bourbon casks to make our whiskey. We have a lovely flavour abacus, tweed abacus on the wall with all the different vibrant colours, each identifying the different flavours that appear during whiskey production. It's right in the centre of the distillery, and there's no distractions from outside because it's soundproofed. We've got a lovely copper skylight so we can see actually some sunshine just now. That's unusual. It has been unusual in the last few weeks. So we're in the heart of the distillery here. We have been here for 5.5 years. So upstairs, I'll show you later, there's the actual heart of the distillery where the spirits are made.
Where it all happens. Tell me the amazing story, though, behind the distillery and how it first came about.
So the distillery was an idea of Anderson Bakewell, who we call Burr Bakewell. He has had a long history with Harris. He owns the island of Scarp, which is an island off the north of Harris. And he's been coming here for a long, long time. And he loved it so much. He wanted to share the island, and his kind of famous words were, how can you bottle this island and share it with the world? And then came along some ideas, you know, of a distillery, something that would have a long-term impact on things like the economy locally and employment. The whisky industry is a very long-term investment, long-term vision. It's not an overnight thing. It's not something that will come and go very quickly because of the nature of it. And so he gathered some friends and set about creating the distillery, which took about 8 years in planning before we actually opened our doors.
Why did it take so long, do you think, to realise that vision?
I think some aspects of that were practical. Where would they put the distillery for a start? He knew it wanted to be in Harris, but where would it be in Harris? So a long time spent looking for the right location that had a fresh water source, which a distillery has to have, and planning permission and all the different phases of planning, getting investment and things like that. That took a long time.
And did Burr feel passionately about trying to create long-term employment here so that people, you know, were able to stay on the isle and not have to disappear to other places for work?
Yeah, certainly. I think that was our main purpose, really, is to provide employment. So the world didn't need another single malt whisky or another gin, but Harris did. And that's the way I like to look at it. So it certainly ticked that box. And because of where we are, there's lots of different elements of our business. It's not just making spirits or distilling and warehousing and all these things, obviously. But then we have e-commerce and business and the visitor centre here. There's lots and lots of different opportunities for people young and older as well. So very often you'll find on the island, not everybody wants to go away. So we kind of fill that gap a little bit with some of the younger folk. We've had 3 or 4 school leavers who left and are still with us, but doing very different jobs now to the one they started with us, and they're on a career path.
So when you started, was it just whiskey at the beginning?
No, it wasn't. We've made Isle of Arras gin from the very start. We are a whiskey distillery first and foremost. So we're a whiskey distillery that makes gin.
Wow, I know nothing about whiskey making, so I want to ask you about that in a moment. But we said in the introduction that you're one of the Tarbert 10, which I think is a lovely name and presumably fills you with pride when you think that you were right here at the beginning. What was it like in those early days, and what was the big Cayley like when you finally opened?
Yeah, so I started a year before we opened. So we were planning and we were obviously finishing things like interior design and procuring everything we needed, starting to look at staffing and how we would actually run things from day to day. The build was still going on during that time, so we would come in here in hard hats and we'd be practicing our tours around the builders when they were snagging and finishing things off. So we had temporary offices and we all worked towards, yeah, what it would be like on that first day when we opened. Obviously we had consultants to help us with distillation and flavour and all the different things, because whisky is a completely new thing to all the distillers that worked here. So the company invested quite heavily in employing people that were from the island and teaching them how to do that, rather than bringing in already trained and qualified distillers from the mainland or from anywhere else. All our production team come from different backgrounds, but none of them were working in the spirits industry or distilling. They're all from engineering, building, joinery, different things like that, IT backgrounds.
And how do you look back on day one when the doors open for the very first time?
Well, that was a great day. So we opened and we were all very proud, you know. So the Tarbert 10, even when we opened here, had become the Tarbert 14, I think, or something like that, because we realised very early on that there weren't enough people really, and it was going to be very busy, especially in the kind of visitor side front of house. So yeah, it was just incredibly exciting. I don't think any of us will ever forget it. Yeah, we all feel really proud. We've got a great sense of ownership because we feel like it's ours, but we don't have the financial burden of it at the end of the day.
Which is probably just as well, because it's very beautifully designed. It looks very, very expensive. I mean, the design side of it's breathtaking.
Yeah, it is lovely. And designed quite specifically to not be very incredibly modern or trendy, because that's not really the sort of island style. Quite industrial in places, because I suppose it is a factory through the walls there in the Spirit Hall, to an extent it is a production plant.
It's got a contemporary feel, but it also looks like it really celebrates the island. I mean, I'm looking at tweed jackets hanging up in here. It feels like you're a real community, aren't you? And really pulled together when you do something new.
Yes, there's 30 of us now. So we started at 10. And now there are 35 years later. So it is like a family. Many of us are family. My husband works here. There are 3 or 4 married couples in amongst us, and some other family members that work. But just being part of a small community, we mostly knew each other anyway, but now we know each other in a different way because we're colleagues, but we're also friends and family, some of us. So there's quite a nice dynamic here at work.
And am I right in thinking there was a big Cayley on day one?
There was a very big Cayley on day one.
What's that like? I don't really know what a Cayley is, other than that it sounds like a massive party with lots of music and dancing and things. But in the Scottish way, huh?
Yeah, that's it. We had a great day. We had an opening day. So during the day, we had a sort of slightly more formal event with invites, and all our investors were here and all our directors. And as the day went on, we opened it up to everybody. So the warehouse next door here that I'll show you in, that was empty at the time because it was brand new, so there were no casks in it, there was nothing there, and that's where we had our Cayley. Put a stage up at one end and we invited everybody. There were many hundreds of people here.
And the culmination, presumably, of a tough year's work, I would imagine it was pretty hectic trying to get it ready.
Yeah, it was pretty hectic. It was very last minute, like many things are, but yeah, we go with the flow, tend to in the islands.
Before we talk about the gin, mm-hmm. Will you give us a sense of whisky and what makes your whisky special here and the process?
So whisky is made 3 ingredients simply. I don't know if you know much about whisky production.
I don't.
You don't?
No.
Barley, water and yeast. And it's absolutely magical what happens during the process. So when we go upstairs to the Spirit Hall, I'll show you what happens. And it's a long, long-term process, because once it's put into an oak cask, it has to sit for 3 years before it's legally classed as Scotch whisky. Gin, for example, is a much quicker process. So the whisky, we're at the very early stages of our whisky journey, really. Our oldest casks are only 5 years old now. So some are maturing and we're sampling some to see whether it can give us any indications of when we might release it. We're not interested in age statements. You know, we won't leave it for a number of years, specifically like 10 or 12 years. We're hoping the spirit will tell us when it's ready.
Are you able to describe the process for us, for our listeners?
Not really.
A tiny bit of it. I have no idea what happens to the whiskey.
So very basically, the barley is ground up and it's put through a mash tun, a piece of equipment called a mash tun, which is basically a big porridge. And all the sugars are released from the, are kind of washed off the barley grain. So we're collecting all that sugary liquid. That then is put into large vessels called washbacks, and yeast is added there. And then the fermentation starts to happen. And that's where the alcohol occurs from. That alcohol then, after a period of fermentation, and lots of flavour happens in both of those processes, lots of fruit flavours that we indicate on the abacus there. And then after a period of fermentation, that liquid is then distilled. And what comes off the still at the end of the day is what's put into a cask, sat aside in a warehouse to mature for a number of years.
And you're busy, I know, with whisky today. You've put us in your diary in between some whisky events. What are you doing with the whisky today?
What we're doing with the whisky today is basically sampling some from our earliest filled casks. So they're sort of 5 years old, our oldest casks. A new distillery, that's really, you know, we're very young in terms of distilleries, only 5 years old, but we seem to have achieved quite a lot in that time. And so we've reached, this is a big milestone for us. We'll never not have whisky again. We're past that stage. It's legally whisky, and as I said, sort of 5 years is our oldest. So that's what I've been doing today, along with Harrison, my young colleague, and Gordon Steele is our flavour consultant.
And do you enjoy that side of it?
Love it, yeah. It's actually new for me. I've just sort of embarked on learning how to be a blender.
Ah, that's interesting.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, sounds great. Let's move on to gin. I think I should know a little bit more about gin production, only because some's made locally to where I live in London.
Oh, yes, right.
Which is really, really nice. But give us a sense of the gin and what's special about Harris Gin and how that's made.
Mm-hmm. Harris Gin, we use 9 botanicals. We have a lovely little 300 litre gin still. She's affectionately named the Dottoch, who was an old lady who lived in Scarp, the island that Burr owns. We like to say that it's small and feisty, just like she was. and they had a great relationship. Came from different worlds, but she told him exactly what she thought of things on a daily basis. So that's where the name comes from, the Dottoch. But our gin specifically is sugar kelp, is the local ingredient that we use, which is a seaweed that grows around the coast here, harvested by Lewis Mackenzie, who I think you're going to be meeting. So that gives our gin its specific sort of Hebridean flavour. It can be described usually as, it's refreshing. It's very refreshing. It's got some floral and citrus in there, but the sugar kelp gives it that nice maritime edge. That's quite difficult to pinpoint exactly what that flavour is.
And water. Do you use rainwater too?
Our water source is about half a mile up the hill from here. There are two lochs there. When I talked earlier about the location of a distillery, it has to have a water source nearby. That's where ours is.
Lewis sounds quite a character, is he?
He is. He's very, very knowledgeable. Amazing to talk to. You'll learn an awful lot from him.
Well, I caught up with the elusive diver, Lewis Mackenzie, who spends his days gathering the sugar kelp seaweed by hand from sea lochs. Lewis, thanks so much for breaking off. I know this is a really busy time of year for you. I know absolutely nothing about sugar kelp seaweed. Will you give us a potted sort of story of what it is and how you harvest it?
Certainly. Well, sugar kelp is one of the lowest down of the kelp family on the foreshore. So it's exposed only at very low spring tides. It's a seasonal seaweed. It grows predominantly from January through to May. A great food source for winkles. It basically provides a lot of shelter for species like lumpsucker fish and sea sticklebacks to lay their eggs. So it's kind of in demand from other species. And because of that, it suffers from what they call biofouling. And that's why we harvest basically in a very specific period between February and May. And that's when it's clean and it's at its best in terms of the mannitol sugar content that's in the fronds. On a low spring tide, I don't know if you know about the tidal differences in the Hebrides.
Not really. This is all new to me, which is all quite exciting.
So every lunar cycle, when the moon is full and when there's no moon, we get low tides and high tides. The other 2 weeks each month, the tide doesn't move as much. So vertical height, every 6 hours, the water will come in and go out up to 5 metres in vertical height. So where we're sitting here just now, those will all be bone dry in 5 hours. At low spring tides, I basically snorkel for the sugar kelp using a dry suit and a mask and a snorkel and flippers. Each frond is picked from the stalk individually, so the stalk or the plant isn't killed. Plants live for about 4 years, and I can harvest each plant twice each spring. So, you know, it's very, very sustainable. I manage the areas that we harvest so that the quality of the kelp actually improves once you get into the second year of managing that area, because you're taking newer fronds rather than old fronds. So the biofouling that's on them is limited, and the quality of the kelp is just right for the process that it goes through before it reaches distillery. So I harvest the fronds. They go into chilled poly boxes on the boat once they've been washed at the harvest site. We take all the coordinates of the harvest site using GPS, so we know exactly where each frond has come from, you know, within meters. The fronds are then temperature controlled until I put them to a seaweed drying factory just outside Stornoway later in the day. They're laid on racks and then dried using hot air down to a humidity that is appropriate for the use in the gin. Then vacuum packed and going into the gin. It's part of the kind of secret recipe that makes Harris Gin unique. The quantities of the sugar kelp that's used is very specific.
And presumably it gives the gin that flavour of tasting like the Isle of Harris.
Yeah, because it's straight out of the sea, it's washed in seawater at the harvest site, it's temperature controlled, you're getting a food grade premium product going into the botanicals that form the gin. And because it's so fresh and then preserved in the appropriate way through drying, you get the saltiness of the dehydrated salt water on the outside of the frond, but then you also get the mannitol sugar coming through into globules on the outside of the leaf. So you get the saltiness and you get the sweetness.
Your eyes absolutely sparkle when you talk about sea kelp. How on earth did you end up with this job?
The distillery, when they came up with a recipe for the sugar kelp, they contacted the local seaweed processing factory. And that predominantly processes ASCO, which is this bubbly seaweed we're looking at here.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't obviously have anybody who could supply sugar kelp, but I supplied them with this type of seaweed. So they asked, did I know where there was any? And I said, yeah. So it just took off from there.
So are you a diver by trade, Lewis?
Yeah, I've been scallop diving commercially for 30 years, for hand dive scallops.
Oh my goodness, what a job. I mean, what made you want to be a diver?
Unemployment.
Really? Seriously?
Just jumped in one day when I was 20, borrowed someone's diving suit and didn't look that difficult. So I read the Subaqua manual and then thought, well, I'll just have a go, so off I went.
And what do you love about your job? I mean, the thing that sort of strikes me is the solitude of it and being in this beautiful surround.
Yeah, but you're never alone. You know, you might not be people around, but you're surrounded by wildlife. So it's never lonely. And it's a great place to just relax. You're working, but you're relaxed at the same time. There's no one pushing you to do anything except the tide, because I've got to work with the tide. So at low tide, it's always a race against time before the tide races an enormous lot. But like how you lost your shoes yesterday almost on the beach.
Yes, the tide's your master. And unfortunately, I didn't realise that the tide should have been my master. I did nearly lose my hiking boots yesterday, which I'm not quite sure how I'd have got back over those rocky cliffs. But what sort of wildlife do you experience when you're out there?
Well, you've got two sets of wildlife. You've got the wildlife that you see above the water, and you've got the wildlife that's in the water. And because I'm in the water with a face mask on and a snorkel, coming across lobsters, crabs, shrimps, fish, all the range of tiny little things like, you know, cowrie shells and painted top shells, tower shells. Sometimes otters come past me, guillemots. And then on the boat, when you're sorting out the seaweed, you've got white-tailed eagles above you, teals beside you, and all the range of wild birds in the summer, especially from the last month that we harvest from April through to May. We get the start of all the migratory birds coming back. So we get common terns, Arctic terns, gannets, and my favourite are the great skuas.
Oh, what are they like?
They migrate from North Africa back here every summer. They're a really aggressive kind of predator. They prey on other birds. highly intelligent and completely fearless. So you can bond with them quite easily because they've got no fear of man. So you can hand feed them, you know, when they're flying past. If you've got the boat going into the wind and they're flying past, you can hold up a fish and they'll fly past and take it out of your hand.
Is it ever dangerous, Lewis? Do you ever have any sort of hairy moments out there?
You just respect the weather. It's the wind. The wind and the sea state, you just have to be careful of. But just respect it and it's perfectly safe.
When you come from a place like Lewis or Harris or this part of the world, how do you appreciate how beautiful it is?
Yeah, you're never really tired of it. And you appreciate it when you go away to somewhere else. If I go to Glasgow 3 days and I'm getting twitchy, it's grey. So compared to here, so I'm always glad to get back.
So do you think it's time for me to go back to the distillery and actually sample some Harris gin?
Well, it's coming up to probably 10:30 or something like that in the morning, so that's probably about right.
Gin o'clock time?
Yeah, right time to start. And then you've got the rest of the day just to carry on.
And lose my hiking boots. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I know that this is a really, really busy time. Just tell us quickly what you're off to do now.
I'm away to survey part of North Harris Estate for breeding birds and deer. So I've got a 12-mile hike up into the hills ahead of me today.
It's a tough job, hey, but someone it has
does.
To do it.
Exactly.
So that's the sea kelp. Tell me about the botanicals and the little bottles that I've noticed with the little pipettes in. What exactly is a botanical and what does that bring to the gin?
The other botanicals that we use. So we use 8 other botanicals. We use coriander, bitter orange peel, cassia bark, licorice root, angelica root, orris root, and Java peppercorns. So those all give the flavours that I mentioned earlier, the sort of floral groupings of flavours and citrus and a little bit of spice from the cassia bark and the Java pepper, it's called cubebs, Java peppercorns. So it all comes together with this amazing, lovely, refreshing flavour. And the sugar kelp, we kind of believe, gives it sort of brings all these botanicals together and adds this little extra, what we refer to as maritime quality, but it's difficult to pinpoint, a little bit of a umami sort of flavour to it.
Do you think we should make Convex Conversation history and have our first tasting?
Absolutely.
It's only quite early in the morning, but it's never too early for a little sample of gin, is it?
Not in Harris. It's usually gin o'clock somewhere.
Gin o'clock somewhere. Yeah. Somewhere around the world it's gin o'clock, isn't it? You've got some gin here. I noticed you brought it in the glasses neat. Is that how you taste it?
Well, we always do our sampling neat because you can really pick out the different flavours. If we were to add ice and tonic immediately, it's a gin and tonic and that detail's lost in the flavour. So you can really appreciate it neat.
Shall we have a taste?
Yep.
Shall we see? Okay. Do you have to smell it first?
I would smell it, yeah.
Okay. Let's swirl it around a bit. Oh, wow. It smells beautiful, doesn't it?
It's lovely. It is.
Do you ever drink it neat at home? Do you always have it with tonic and sometimes you like it as a sort of little mister?
It's like a nice sort of warming drink if you have it neat. And I think in the past, most gin and tonic drinkers would never drink gin like that, but we find ours anyway is really nice like that. I normally would drink it as a gin and tonic with red grapefruit, which brings out the sort of citrus flavours that we have.
It's
Can you smell anything specific in it?
That's difficult.
I mean, that's full strength, so it's quite difficult to nose.
Yeah,
when we nose our spirits, we reduce it so that it doesn't, you know, sort of burn your nose.
It definitely feels like, somehow it feels like the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it does bring the island to life. I don't know why. I can sort of see scenery as I taste it.
Well, that's amazing. And that's what we're set out to do, really. And if you see the bottle, definitely looks like the island. And the bottle designers, had they not come and spent time here sitting on the beach and having a dram at sundown and things, we don't believe it would have looked like that. The bottle certainly looks like the island, and we do hope that what you just described within the bottle makes you think of Harris. And
I think if you took this home and drank it at home, I think it would immediately transport you here. Mm-hmm. The scenery is so beautiful here. The water's really gorgeous. The colours are so muted, aren't they? Really muted colours on the mountains. And somehow you've managed to get that in the glass, and it's amazing. I can't really describe all the different flavours. There's a slight salt, and I think a bit of salt in there somewhere.
And that's coming from the sugar kelp. It's salty and a little sweet. It sounds sweet because of its name. has a compound called mannitol in it. That's a sort of sugar carbohydrate. But it's certainly salty if you were to taste it by itself. The sugar kelp, not the gin.
Yes. And what do you do with the sugar kelp in the gin process?
So in the gin process, it's added with the other botanicals to the gin and then it's distilled. So we macerate basically a large muslin bag of botanicals and the sugar kelp in a separate one. And the spirits macerated and then put through the gin still. Distilled. The sugar kelp is taken out slightly earlier than the other botanicals, so it doesn't overpower.
What do you taste when you taste it? What images does it conjure up for you?
I think it certainly does sort of sum up our sort of surroundings somehow. It's easy for me to say that because I'm here. But I think of the bottle and I think of the contents. And the bottle's beautiful, obviously, and it speaks so much of the island, but we do say that kind of sells it once, but the contents sell it over and over again. And it's very familiar. And I think that's what's really nice about it. There's not an awful lot of botanics in there. So 9 botanics are probably more than enough. They don't compete with each other. You just get them sort of appearing in your mouth, don't you, one after another?
Yes, certainly do. The bottle's really special. I'm a packaging person's dream because I would buy that bottle if it had water in it, I think, just because it's such a beautiful bottle. And the fact it's got your gin in it is fantastic. But what's the story behind the bottle and how does it look like the aisle?
The bottle was just designed by Stranger and Stranger in London. They came up to Harris and they kind of spent 2 or 3 days here in the very early days. The bottle was designed before this building went up. The style of the bottle, obviously, it's very reminiscent of, you know, a beach when the tide recedes and you get the lines on the beach.
Ah, I see.
The waves is another way to describe it. I see it very like the beach when the tide goes out. Obviously the waves and maybe a little bit towards herringbone and tweed as well. The colour of the bottle with the turquoise in the base is obviously a nice hint towards the maritime, our location next to the sea, the maritime quality of the sugar kelp in the gin.
And the glasses go with it beautifully, don't they?
Yes.
And they're in the same kind of style.
Yeah, they were designed around the bottle.
Yeah.
And in the base of the bottle, you'll notice if you pick one up, it says Esse Quam Videri, just in the glass in the bottom. And that's the Bakewell family motto, which means to be rather than seem to be. So we tried to kind of live like that here at the distillery, to be, not to seem to be. Everything we do was new to us 5, 6, 7 years ago. So we've never pretended that we were experts in what we do. It was new to us, so we've been learning. A lot of distilleries are, you know, have hundreds of years of history, but we're kind of making history here. It's all those things together. It's a story, isn't it? The story, all the different elements come together. And then when you taste what's in the glass, then it sort of makes sense, I think.
It does. It certainly does together. Make sense. And what does Burr Bakewell think to it all? This was his dream. This was his vision. This was his ambition. And you've all, through a lot of hard work, made it a reality and made something certainly world class. How does he feel about what's been going on for the last 5 years and where you are now?
I saw him just last week. He was here and he missed Harris an awful lot in the last year because he wasn't able to travel, of course. He's such a humble man, but he's so proud, I think, of what we've done. He had an idea and everybody's come together to realise that idea. He's like the phrase in the bottom of the bottle. He's sort of quiet and understated and hidden away a little bit like that. But yeah, I think fiercely proud is how I would describe how he feels.
And how popular is the gin worldwide?
Well, we have lots of different export markets now. We didn't at all to begin with, but the gin has been an amazing success for us within the UK and in lots of different export markets now, as I say. I can't tell you all off the top of my head. But it's amazing. It's just so well received and the world didn't need another gin. But we seem to be doing very well in that market.
And you said the same thing about the whiskey, that the world didn't necessarily need another whiskey. But having sampled what you've got so far, which is only 5 years old, are you confident that you're also going to have something very, very special from here that really tastes of Harris and is a bit different to all the other whiskies on the market?
Yeah, I think so. That's definitely how we feel at this stage that we're at. You know, the question should be, is it Harris rather than is it a certain region? So this is a new whiskey region. You know, we're not in Speyside, we're not in Islay, we're not Lowland. So it's a new region, so it should be slightly different. And I think our main focus is just, is it really, really good? Is it complex enough? Does it say this is Harris?
Will it be peaty? I don't know whether Harris is peaty or not.
It'll be medium peated, yeah.
Medium peat sounds perfect. I think Full-on peat's a bit too much for me, but I do like that peaty flavour.
Right, yeah, it's medium peated, and there is peat on the island, lots of peat, so it would have been unusual to have no peat in it.
It's interesting to me that you feel that you have a real sense of community on the isle. When we first arrived today, you talked about school children helping with some designs with the Harris tweed. Your jackets are made of Harris tweed here. I gather one of the designers worked for Alexander McQueen. And don't you have secret little messages sewn into your jackets?
Yes, we do have. A bit like the message in the base of the bottle. It's the same message. It's Esse quam videre. It's just on the... Let's just show you that there. So it's embroidered into the collar. Can you see that?
Yeah, I can. That's absolutely stunning. And the tweed itself is beautiful, isn't it?
So Judy Clark's the lady who designed the tweed. And Alison MacDonald is the lady who lives up in Ness. And she does the embroidery work on the collars.
That's stunning. It reminds me, my grandfather died when he was 100.
Wow, really?
Went over the top at the Battle of the Somme.
Amazing.
And was never seen without a Harris tweed jacket on. And I kid you not, it would be August and very sunny up north in England. And he'd be on the beach in beautiful shoes, lovely pair of trousers, and a Harris tweed jacket. So it has
great
memories.
Would he approve of these, do you think?
Oh, he would so approve. He would have really suited that beautiful blue colour as well with the teal. Is it important? Is collaboration with the talents that you have on the isle really important to you and embraced?
We have lots of collaborations with different people up and down the country, but I think involving the children here is quite important to us. So we have done various projects, but the tweed project was the biggest one so far. But, you know, we're only at the beginning of our journey, so we tend to do a lot more of that, you know, with young kids and with talent here. And there aren't great pools of staff because we're on a small island. We don't have a huge population. So we do intend to do more with school leavers, training them up to do specific things, because there's very specified jobs here as well that everybody's had to learn from scratch, you know, with consultants. But as we get older as a distillery, we need to have less of that support and be more self-sufficient.
You also collaborate with Amanda Sorin, who
yes.
is an apothecary. It's taken me a long time to be able to say the word apothecary, who will also be featured on the podcast. Amanda's a very special lady too, isn't she?
She is. I've known Amanda since the very beginning of my distillery journey. And Amanda actually makes the sugar kelp aromatic water for us. Would you like to try it, Robin?
Oh, yes, please. If that's another excuse to have another mouthful of gin during a podcast.
There's sugar kelp in our gin. Anyway, that's our Hebridean ingredient along with the other eight botanicals. This is distilled sugar kelp. Pure distilled sugar kelp. Amanda distills like we do. She has a small copper still. She makes her own flower waters and essential oils and things like that that she'll tell you about. But this is specifically made for Erigen to add a little more of that maritime flavour.
Gosh,
and
just
you add a few drops. And
just intensifies it, doesn't it? So you've got a little brown bottle there, which is perfect, isn't it? Because it doesn't let the sunlight in. And a little pipette. And how many drops did you put in?
I put three or four drops in there. It's really up to your own taste. It's quite nice to sample, you know, to have a little bit of the neat gin and add some drops of sugar kelp and then build your gin and tonic up from there if that's how you're going to drink it.
Do you know, I think I'm going anti-tonic now.
Really?
I think the tonic would spoil this. It has such a beautiful flavour. It doesn't taste like it needs it. I could imagine the gin and tonic with pink grapefruit. That's something I'd put in a normal gin, actually. Why pink grapefruit? Why do you use that?
Really, because, well, the botanicals that give the citrus flavour in our gin are coriander and bitter orange peel. Both of those are orange. Coriander is like orange flavour normally. But we find when we nose it and drink it, it's more of a grapefruit flavour that comes through. So very early on, we decided that would be the best garnish for our gin specifically. There are so many. Every gin has their own particular garnish that they think goes best with the flavour. So grapefruit is ours.
And what next for the distillery? What are your ambitions and Burr's ambitions for it?
Well, certainly, you know, we're all working up to the launch of the Heroch, which will be our single malt whisky. It's going to be called the Heroch. That's the name of an inhabitant of Harris. That's our focus, really, at the moment. A lot of the story's been about gin in recent years, but now that we're getting closer to the sort of time when we'll have whisky for sale, that's a huge milestone for us.
And who is the Heroch?
The Heroch is, well, a Heroch is a person from Harris.
Ah, a person from Harris.
So I'm a Heroch.
So you're a Heroch. It's not some man sitting by his fire somewhere in a little stone cottage somewhere.
A Heroch is an inhabitant of Harris. As an inhabitant of Lewis, it's called a Leosoch, or from Skye, a Skianoch.
That's so quite, the quite tricky to get your mouth around.
The name of the whisky is going to be called the Herrach.
The Herrach. And so because you're tasting now and you've decided not to sort of go for either 10 years or 12 years, like often single malts say on the bottle, do you have any idea when it might be ready for sale, or is it just too early to tell? Will it tell you when it's ready?
I think, well, we hope it'll tell us when it's ready. We're at that early stage of nosing samples and things, so yeah, we don't know yet. We often say it'll be ready when it's ready.
Ready when it's ready, and I'm presuming ready when it's ready. It'll come in a beautiful bottle too, will it?
It certainly will, yes. I can't tell you much about the bottle, but Airbus often, Simon describes it as the big brother of the gin bottle.
So it's already designed and,
yes,
and ready to go.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's been so lovely to talk to you today. Thank you so much for sharing the stories with me.
And you're welcome.
I'm looking forward to having a little look round as well. I'm clinging on to this little glass, hoping that you haven't noticed that I've still got some left in it.
I'm very pleased you enjoy the gin and that you described it as sort of summing up how the island feels to you.
I've never been to the Outer Hebrides, and it's interesting, when I was booking to come here, it's interesting how busy you are at the minute.
Yeah, very.
And one would have thought that post-pandemic, people were ready to go out and socialise. I felt completely the opposite. I wanted to be out in nature, mm-hmm. out on a beach with nobody and just be in the wilderness. So I was quite shocked that lots of people obviously feel like me, because trying to book a hire car or get a hotel at the minute, mm-hmm. when I say it's busy, it's never really rush hour, is it, in Harris? I mean, it's still fairly remote, but it's very special to come here.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that you describe it that way. With the island, I mean, we've always been a destination that, you know, this time of year. What does get very busy are things that are limited, like hotel rooms and ferry spaces and a seat on the flight or a restaurant table, because we don't have very many of them. But you'll certainly never be on a crowded beach.
No, or a crowded road. I think it was crowded a little bit with sheep and lambs. Right. It's just definitely the way to go. But thank you for sharing all of this.
It's
I think I
to
need to come back and talk Harris Tweed. What do you think? Do you think that's another story we should tell?
Definitely. There are lots of stories to tell. Lots of interesting people to meet. You should go and see the tweed being woven. You can do that in many different places. And with Harris Tweed, part of the sort of regulation is that it's woven at somebody's home or on their crofts.
So there's
a reason. You see a factory with lots of looms in it. It's woven in people's homes and then sent to the mill for finishing. So at this tweed here, specifically this one, has been woven by one of our colleagues, because he's a part-time weaver. He's full-time with us, but he weaves at home. So that's really nice that he was able to weave the tweed for us just in South Harris, half an hour away.
So I think it means a return visit, doesn't it? If I come back, can I pop in and see you?
Yeah, you come back for a gin and tonic anytime.
And maybe help you with the whisky tasting
yes.
too, maybe. Shona, thank you so much. You've been listening to Shona McLeod, one of the Isle of Harris Distillery's original employees, part of the Tarbert 10. Thank you so much for your company today. Don't forget, you can download and subscribe to our podcast series, theconvex.podbean.com, or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or just ask Alexa. I'll see you next week. Bye for now. Thank you.